You may be familiar with this work, maybe not. Aristotle, when he was trying to ponder what is the good life, wrote a work called the Nicomachean Ethics. Sometimes people just refer to it as the Ethics, okay, of Aristotle. And he gave a really central role to friendship. And he wrote something in that that I think says it all. He said, without friends, no one would choose to live, though he had all other goods. That is a pretty strong statement about friendship. I mean, that even if we had every other good, we wouldn't want to live if we didn't have friendship. Now, this is the perspective of Aristotle. He's living several centuries before the time of Christ. And he named three different kinds of friendship. And I'm going to start with this, even though it's very elemental, just because some of you may not already be familiar with some of his terminology. But you might have to let go of a little bit of our modern usage of some of these terms to get what he's saying. But this is just foundational, and hopefully you'll get where I'm going. First, he talks about the friendship of use. Now, you might say, use? Use is not friendship at all. If I use another person for something, that sounds terribly negative. It sounds like it's all about self. It doesn't sound like friendship at all. But what he meant by a friendship of use was a relationship where each person receives a recognized and understood benefit from the other, and that's kind of the limit of the relationship. So I'm going to give you an example. Your dentist, okay? If you have a good dentist, you expect that when you go to the dentist, they take good care of your teeth, and he expects that you're going to pay him fairly, he or she, for the services given. And you don't expect that you're necessarily going to have more of a relationship than that, okay? That's what Aristotle means by a friendship of use, okay? He's not talking about abusive use. He's talking about we each have an agreed upon goal in this relationship, and that's all we're after. That's the friendship of use. But that's just the simplest and most basic level. The next, he calls the friendship of pleasure. Again, we have to let go a little bit of the way we think of that term. Because what he's talking about is we have relationships to people where we have a pleasant activity that we share in common, and we get together and do that thing together. So maybe we both like to play a certain game or play cards. A tennis partner would be a great example of a friendship of pleasure. Two people who are well matched in the game of tennis might really like to come together periodically. They regularly play with each other, and they might chat about things in life, but they might just say, this is all we do. We get together and we play tennis, and we don't really know a whole lot more than just general chatter with each other about the weather of the game, whether it's going well. And as long as both people understand either the friendship of use or the friendship of pleasure, that that's all they expect out of the relationship. Then that is friendship, but it's very imperfect friendship, right? It's not imperfect in the moral sense of good or evil. Imperfect in the sense of fullness or lack of fullness. So those are the starting ground. But obviously, we all want more than that. The kind of friendship that he says we don't want to live without is something more. And Aristotle calls that kind of friendship, sometimes it's translated perfect, sometimes it's translated virtuous. Mr. Cutterback in his book tends to call it authentic, and Focus kind of picks up that language. I have a preference for virtuous, but I know why some people would use authentic, okay? Because virtuous sounds kind of stodgy in the world unless you're a real lover of Thomas Aquinas already, in which case you know what virtue is, and therefore you love it, okay? But they're all the same, and I'm going to use these terms interchangeably, perfect, virtuous, or authentic friendship. And this is the one we can't live without. This is the one that gives the value to our lives. This is the one I'm going to spend the most time discussing for that very reason. For both Aristotle and Thomas Aquinas, this friendship is one of the most beautiful gifts of life. Actually, the scriptures say the same thing. If you read the book of Sirach, chapter 6, it talks about friendship, and it says that a person who finds a friend has found a rare treasure. Okay? So this is not something you're going to find with lots of people. It's not something you're going to find often in life. And it's something that's going to be so important, it's going to make life worth living. Okay? And this is the friendship that's one of the most beautiful gifts of life, because it's loving another for the sake of the other. And I'm going to really unpack what does that mean. It's not for the benefit you derive from for yourself. It's very other-focused. Both Thomas Aquinas and Aristotle agree that there are three main qualities to this kind of friendship, but they see those a little differently, so I'm going to point that out as I go. So I'm going to look with you at the three qualities, and within looking at those, look at what might be some of the kind of obstacles we might encounter to living those, that and how we might overcome those obstacles. So that's kind of my modus operandi here. So the first quality, and the one without which there can be no virtuous friendship, is what Aristotle calls benevolence. Now, if you know a little bit classical language, you should know that even if you look at the word itself, benevolence, bene, the good, okay, the volere, to will, to wish, okay, benevolence in its roots is to will the good of another, to want what is genuinely good for another person. And they add, it means to will the good of the other for the other's sake. It's for, so I mean, this sounds ideal because it is in a beautiful way. That I will, I don't just vaguely desire, I will the good of another person for that person's sake. This is the first. Now we're going to have to do three qualities, but I'm going to talk about the first. Because this is the most fundamental element of virtuous friendship. If you don't will the good of the other, I mean, that's why there's a great imperfection in the others, right? I may or may not really will the total good of my dentist or my tennis partner, although you'd be a better dentist or dental patient or tennis partner if you did will the good of the other. Okay? But in virtuous friendship, this is absolutely essential. And so to will the good of the other, it requires things that we do run up against really big challenges with today. Because I'm going to start with one thing you have to possess in order to will the good of the other, and that is you have to actually know that there is a good. Okay? And you have to agree on what that good is. Now, that might sound really simplistic, but I think it's one of the most difficult roadblocks in our contemporary culture. If we don't believe there is truth, if we don't believe there is a true good that is at the core of the human heart, human desire, human experience, that I can will for the other. If I really am a pure relativist, what's good for you is good for you, what's good for me is good for me, say la vie. Bon appetito. Okay, you're mixing your French, your Italian, it's really bad. Anyway, but it's really central to being a friend that I actually have a true sense of what is the good for the other. Because how can I will the good for you if I don't know what the good is? So if we think there is no true good at the level of our human nature that can be applied to each individual, as well as particular goods that might apply to the individual that I want to befriend, because there are universal goods, right? Things that as a human being we all should be directed towards. But there are also individual goods. That isn't being relativistic. I mean, to say that for a certain person, a certain thing is good because of their personal needs and history, okay, that's part of being a friend. So there's both the universal goods we long for each other and the particular goods. So if we don't believe that there are objective goods, then we really can't will a good for another person. We can just say, oh, well, I generally wish them well, okay? But how can you give a friend good advice if you don't really believe there is a true good for them to pursue? How can you pursue activities in common if you don't think, well, there's some things that are more perfecting of our personhood and some things that are less? Because if you don't really know this true good and will it for the other, you could actually harm a person, and that is de facto against friendship. You know, some of the things we call friendships. I mean, maybe when we were in a place of immaturity in our lives, for myself, when I was growing up, one of my cousins was one of my best friends in the world. And when I got to be teenagers, I always had more of a leader personality. She always had more of a follower personality. That didn't mean 100% on both sides, but more like that. And I called her my best friend. She was someone dear to me. And as we became teenagers, one of the things I realized is every choice I made, she made too. And so if I got into a certain kind of thing, she'd get into it too. And I started making choices that were destructive for me, but what I saw was that they were destructive for her. And I thought, oh my gosh, the day I woke up and realized, if I really love her, I gotta change me. Like, I'm not being very virtuous, and she's following right into the path that I'm in. And if you don't, you should love yourself enough not to fall into things that are destructive, but for love of her is how I started to change my life. I started to realize, whoa, I want to do a real good thing so that she can have a model of a goodness, because I saw the pain that was coming in her life from my bad decisions. So real friendship wills the good of the other, but has to know there is a good. So one of the things that we can do is like seek to know ever more what real good is. Now, for those of us who have faith, there are sources for knowing the real good. You know, as we ponder the Word of God, as we learn more about our faith, as we grow deeper in our relationship with the Lord, we should be becoming more truthful in our understanding of what the real good is. That is a way that you are deepening your capacity to befriend another person. But it's not just knowing the good, it's also willing that good. And this, when we say we will the good of another, it doesn't mean that, like, I force them to do only good things, because we certainly can't take away the freedom of one another. But when I really love another as a friend, what I want is their full flourishing, the full exercise of their free will in the good. And so, you know, when we talk about knowing the good and willing the good as if it's almost two separate things, in practice, it's actually one. Because we always act upon what we believe is good. I mean, St. Thomas Aquinas says, even when we choose wrongly, even when we choose sinful things, we choose them under the aspect of good. I mean, if you cheat on a test, it's not because you want to cheat on a test. It's because you want the good grade to get the good mark, to get the good position in life, right? He said, you don't, and this is a really important observation about human nature. If people are doing things that look self-destructive and other destructive, they're not doing it because it's destructive. There's some misperception of what the real good is. Okay? And so in ourselves, in those we love, we have to not only seek to know what that good is, but to will it for the other. And this strengthening of our wills is something we really have to work at. I mean, depending on your personality, your own temperament, your own kind of built-in character, you can struggle more or less with willing anything. Willing is not just, oh, I wish it would happen. It's actually being willing to take the steps to make it happen. So actually, I think for us today, there can be a challenge in this area that we live in a culture that kind of doesn't encourage commitment. You know, we kind of think of, we like to keep all our options open, right? For this talk tonight, you were like, I'm only going to say I'm interested in going, not that I'm going. Because what if a better thing arises? We're all like this in the modern world, I think. We're like, some better might come along. I don't want to go hear this sister talk about friendship. I might have some amazing experience somewhere else. Okay. I actually had my students today, I teach the Young Sisters in Formation, I had them pray that everyone who was supposed to be here tonight would hear that and come. I said, you never know. Somebody could meet, like, their future spouse in that room. And they all went, aww. Well, you know, I said, there's a reason for everything in life, and there's a reason why some people need to hear this talk, so you pray that everybody God means to be there will be there. And they go, yeah, we'll pray it. So
you were prayed into this room, so take it seriously.
But to will the good of the other is to actually actively seek to bring about the good for the other. So not only does it take that as we ourselves deepen in our capacity to will, to put things into action that we want, we are becoming more virtuous, but we're also helping our friends. And so it's not I take away their freedom, it's that I encourage them in their use of freedom. I encourage them to take steps in the directions that they're actually discerning what steps to take. And I think that to will this good of the other, we also have to be willing to sacrifice. Because sometimes the good of another requires that I have to sacrifice some of my own good. And so our pop culture doesn't really like to talk about sacrifice much. But I think we're Christians, right? And so when we look at Christ on the cross and we say, now there's the best friend anyone ever had. Because he said, there's no greater love than this, to lay down your life for a friend. So that's the icon of friendship, right? When we look at Christ crucified, we say, there's the icon of friendship, okay? Would I be willing to lay down my own life for the sake of my friend? Well, then, would I be willing to tell them a hard truth or to encourage them in a good that they're having a struggle with? Be patient with them while they are struggling. We have to be willing to will the good of another. We have to be willing to say, it's not all about me. To be able to enter into friendship, you have to be able to look at the good of the other and will it. And it brings us to a third element of benevolence, is that we not only will the good of the other, but we will the good of the other for the other's sake. Okay, so I don't want you to become more patient because then you won't get on my nerves. Okay, that's not willing the good of the other for the other's sake. Okay, if they become more virtuous, I will have a more pleasant experience. It's true that if they become more virtuous, you'll have a more pleasant experience. But it's also true that if you become more virtuous, they'll have a more pleasant experience. So doing it for the other's sake. So why could this be so hard? Well, because we live in the me culture, right? It's all about me. Look at me. I got my profile. I got my Instagram. I got my Snapchat, whatever. Look at me. Look at what I ate last night. Cool. It's really interesting. Like, we have this like hyper-focus on self, okay? So this could be a little challenge of willing the good of the other for the other's sake. So what does this imply? Going beyond and out of ourselves. And I think we wouldn't argue that our contemporary culture is very focused on self. What's good for me? What's convenient for me? What's comfortable for me? But if you want to be a good friend for another person, you have to learn how to look outward. Now, John Paul II, amazing saint and pope, was deeply rooted in the Thomistic concept of the human person, and he loved to speak about the term transcendence. Now, this is not a Zen Buddhist meditation practice when John Paul II is talking about it. What is transcendence? It's going beyond self. Going beyond self. He said you will never become fully mature until you learn transcendence. Maturity is not about getting older. It is not about age. I have taught mature 12-year-olds. And I have met totally immature 70-year-olds. Okay? And so it's not about age, and we all know it. We all know it. If you had to think right now, if I said, picture someone in your mind who is mature, it's not about age. It's about that capacity to think out of yourself towards the good of another. You know, we actually were made to mature as we age, but not well is this supported in our culture. You know, when most people become the most mature is when they have children. Because guess what happens? You who are living in your own world of your own desires and your own wants and needs, suddenly there's this little life that depends on you for everything, and you're like, oh my gosh. If some of you have friends who've got, some of you probably do have friends who've gotten married around, and like suddenly like Mr. or Miss Party Dude or Dudette, okay, is suddenly like mom or dad, and like everything changes. You know, suddenly, I mean, I remember one of my close guy friends, whom I introduced to one of my close girlfriends, who ended up marrying each other, to my great surprise, when they had their first little baby, he, who was like total partier, totally not other-centered, which is why I was really shocked they got married, was suddenly Mr. Dad. He was like, I gotta take care of her. I gotta make sure she never dates a guy like me. I was like, haha, maturity has arrived. And so, what is this, like, what makes us mature, not just becoming parents, but going out of ourselves, looking to what the other needs? And I think in our own culture, we're going to have to kind of work at ourselves to do this. But John Paul talks about it on two levels, that transcendence is both vertical and horizontal, okay? So our prayer life, our relationship to God, is about vertical transcendence, going above my own way of thinking. I mean, when you read the scriptures, it should sound a little different than the interior monologue that's always going on, right? Because suddenly you're being called to look at the world from a different angle, right? A higher way. Faith is supposed to do that for us, you all. We see the world like this, but our faith is supposed to kind of give us a way of looking from above. Kind of, what's the big picture? When I was in high school, a senior, I remember the sister who taught me, one of our sisters taught me a religion class, and she said, a great thing to teach a 17-year-old. When you're experiencing anything, just ask yourself, how important is this in the light of all eternity? And I was like, suddenly everything was not very important. And I thought, your prom date really isn't all that important in the light of all eternity. But it was interesting because it was like she's trying to stretch us and say, like, get out of your little worldview and kind of try to see that there's a bigger perspective. So vertical transcendence, the way we relate to God, can expand our horizontal transcendence. Our way, it should. If you are really praying, it should not make you more self-centered and self-enclosed. Kind of litmus test of real faith, right? That when we are really praying, we're more focused on the people around us. We're more, because the more we love the Lord, the more we love one another. And with a deep and profound love. A love that is capable of willing the real good of the other and capable of discerning what the real good of the other is, okay? So the more we work on that vertical transcendence, our life of prayer, our life of real understanding of the things of God, the more capacity we have for this horizontal transcendence. This, and John Paul would love to repeat, he wrote it in many places, that we only find ourselves by making a sincere gift of ourselves. And you know this. We all get there. We all have those days where we wake up and the world seems miserable. We feel gross. We look gross. Whatever. Bad hair day. Bad everything day. Okay. And we can get all stuck inside. And the best remedy is to go out to someone else. A priest friend of mine would always say to me, give what you need. That is a great prescription. If I had a little prescription pad, I'd write it out for all of you. Sign Dr. Todd. And do it. Give what you need. It is amazing. It can transform your day, your attitude, your mood in a second. Because we can get all stuck in here. I need, and nobody's meeting my needs, and God's not meeting my needs, and nobody's meeting my needs. Or we can say, I'm going to give what I need, and guess what will happen? Your need will be met too. Because we weren't made to be stuck inside. We were made in the image of a God who is all goodness, and there's this great philosophical phrase, goodness is diffusive of itself. What does that mean? God is only God when he's giving. And guess what? You were made in the image of God. What does that mean? You're not going to be fulfilled. You're not going to be happy until you learn how to give. And this does not mean you have to be super talented, super rich, super whatever. Every day, there are ways to give to people right in front of us. Giving our attention. You're giving me great attention right now. You're literally listening, okay? You give someone a smile who's having a rough day. You give someone the notice that you make of the fact that you're actually looking at them and caring how their day was. You're not just saying, how are you? And if they're saying anything more than fine, you're like, don't say me, I gotta go, okay? You know? But you're actually caring about them. That is a way of going out of your own kind of box and giving, and this is maturity. When I start to see the world around me and see the world is not just I'm not like a little cosmos within. I'm actually here to give to others. And when you live life as gift, you receive in the giving. You become more who you're meant to be. So when we look at these three qualities, that we need to will the good, so we need to know what the good is. We need to strengthen our will so that we can will that good and do it for the other's sake. The practical things we can do to help ourselves grow in this benevolence, I've already mentioned a lot of them. But invest time and energy in learning what the true good is. Go to talks at the Thomistic Institute. Develop a sound ethics or moral theology. I mean, that sounds very heady, but the more I know the good, the better. Develop a capacity for strength of will by making choices and sticking to them. You know, if you make a commitment, follow through. I mean, it's interesting because once when I was a young teacher, one of my students came to me and she said, oh, sister, I've got all these things. I'm in five organizations, plus doing sports, doing whatever. And I said, oh, why don't you just drop out of some of them? It was such a not thinking answer. And she looked at me and she said, oh, my parents told me I can't do that because I made a commitment to these organizations. And I looked at her and said, don't listen to what I said, listen to what your parents said. I said, sorry, momentary lapse of reason. Okay. And I said, that's right. Even though it means you're going to have a tough semester, you're going to be caring a lot, do follow through on your commitments. Because I thought, you know, if as a young person, you're already learning to follow through to when you say you're going to be somewhere, do it, you know? I mean, obviously emergencies come up, that's how I'm at that. But you know, follow through, commit, stick to what we say we're going to do, and be willing to make a commitment. To say, I'm going to be there for my friend at whatever time and place, even though three other invitations might come up that might be more appealing, but I said I'd be there. If you're going to be a friend, you're going to have to commit. Right? And that's part of building the capacity for long-term commitments in life. We especially have to develop the capacity to look at others, what I was talking about this transcendence, going out of ourselves, to think about their true good. How can you will the good of another if you aren't actually thinking about what is their true good? So you have to notice the person, get to know them enough that you actually understand what would be really good for them, and to not just seek our own comfort and well-being as the first priority in all things. And cultivation of these capacities will enable us to befriend another. So that's benevolence, goodwill, wishing and willing the good of the other for their sake. The second quality of a virtuous friendship, or authentic friendship, is mutuality. This relates very much to the last point I made about for the sake of the other. You can be friendly towards many people, and you should be. In fact, Aristotle has a name for the virtue, right? Affability. Affability is the virtue of being pleasant, sociable. So look at all these people in this room. You should be pleasant when you're here, not like loudly calling out and really knocking into people. You should be pleasant, okay? That's the virtue of affability. So that in society, we're friendly in our manner, our tone, our conversation. Being friendly with many is what we should be, okay? The scriptures say, be friendly to many but make one in a thousand your confidant. It's interesting. There's a lot of wisdom in that. You should be friendly with L. But that's a little bit different than what we're talking about in entering into friendship. Because this mutuality that is necessary, that goes with benevolence, means that you mutually have to will the good of the other for the other's sake. Now, it is simply true that there may be people who are at a stage in their life where they're not capable of that kind of friendship. And of course we want to still reach out to them, but it's not properly friendship. Something that's one-sided is actually not friendship. It can be charity, it can be altruism, it can be friendliness, which we should exercise. But in order for something to be friendship, it has to be mutual. Both have to will the good of the other for the other's sake. Which is not exactly easy, by the way, come across. So part of increasing and discovering our potential for mutual benevolence would be choosing how we use our leisure or our free time in ways that we're more likely to meet people who actually share our vision of what the common good is, what a good is. Okay? That doesn't mean we're so mutually exclusive that we can't be around anybody who thinks differently than we think or we're going to explode. Okay, it's not that at all. But really, we only have so much free time. I mean, we all have responsibilities, things we do for work, and it's not that you can't have a friendly relationship with people you work with, but when you're pursuing leisure where you potentially meet people for friendship, it helps that you spend time with those who would share your vision of the true good. So that's the benefit of something like University Catholic, right? I mean, that there should be a setting where people who have, at the deepest level, a shared commitment to the same ultimate good can come together and can meet each other. And it doesn't mean that we can be friends with only those who share the same background we do. But it is simply the truth that for a friendship to go really deeply, there do have to be commonly held views of what the real good is. I mean, I can say that one of my best friends in my undergraduate years, before I was a sister, when I was studying undergrad, I was really surprised one day that a girl who lived with me in my dorm came to me and she said, "Oh, the guy I'm dating in the dorm at his university said he wants to introduce you to this guy because you two have the most common, like, understanding of life and the world and everything that we've ever met." And I was like, wow. And I said, "Well, what do you know about him?" And she said, "He's an atheist." And that was the first thing she said. And I was like, "And you think he and I have, like..." I mean, I wasn't a sister yet, but I was kind of, like, pretty much sure that was where God was calling me. And I thought, "And you think that he and I have, like, the most close worldview you've ever seen?" I kind of laughed. I said, "Well, that's interesting." And I got to meet him. And I have never met someone who, from such a different theistic point of view, had such the same view of what the good was. I mean, we really had a very deep common share. I understood once I met him and I started talking with him. And I couldn't believe how our ethics were identical, apart from mass attendance. And I thought, this was very interesting to me. It was actually a great learning experience for me, because I thought, okay, it wasn't about that we came from the same background or we had the same label of our belief system, but actually, I had more in common with him than many of the people that I shared the same faith with, because he was seriously pursuing the question of the good, and what I called godliness and what he called goodness were really the same thing. By the time I was leaving for the convent and we had the final conversation, I said, "I don't think you've ever rejected God. I think you've ever rejected the God of someone's imagination that isn't really God." I said, "If you think he's not an old man with a beard on a throne looking down on you for everything you do wrong, guess what? That's not God anyway." He was like, "Oh." So he believed in goodness. He believed that there was goodness. And I said, "What if your goodness and my God are one and the same? You just have to discover that he's a person who loves you." And he was a very bright guy. And he said, "You might be right." And it's interesting because I think, like, we believe all the same things, working for social justice, living a virtuous life. I mean, we really had very, very common views. And I think that's why we were able to develop an incredibly profound friendship. He was one of my best friends that year, you know, because we were working from the same goal of seeking the good. So I'm not saying, like, we box ourselves in and say there's only one way to pursue this, but you do have to have a common grounding in a view of the good in order to be able to really go deeply in friendship. I happen to live now with 300 people that I share a really common vision of what the ultimate good is. And so I have the capacity to develop really amazing friendships. Because de facto, everyone in my... Once I was in the streets of New Orleans and I ran into an evangelical Christian guy, he said to me, "I've never met a nun. Can I ask you questions?" I didn't go into the distinction of sister versus nun because it was just too early in relationship. Anyway, so I just said, yeah. And he said, "I want to ask you something," about three questions into the conversation. He said, "What percentage of the people you live with do you think are real Christians?" We'd already talked about what a real Christian is. And I looked at him and I was like, 100? And he said, "No." I said, "Seriously, I would not lie to you about this. Our motto is Veritas, I can't lie." And he went, "No, seriously, every woman I live with came to where I live because her number one priority was to live totally, radically for Jesus Christ." And he was like, "Whoa." And I said, "Okay, yeah, we're human. We have our better days, our worst days, but 100% of the people I live with, that's why we're there." And, I mean, he got the enormity of that. And so, I mean, most of us aren't going to have 300 like that. Okay, but seeking out those who share a view of the ultimate good, that will enable us to become the deepest friends because we share that good, that view of the good, the mutuality. Now, the third of the essential qualities, benevolence, mutuality, the third can be translated a couple different ways. Sharing of life, communication, communion in the good. Okay. Aristotle writes in the Ethics that this is the most natural thing in the world. That when two people are friends, they want to share time together. They want to share more than their time. They want to share their lives together. I mean, in a sense, that's how you could define who your real friends are, right? Who would I just love to spend the next hour of my life with? Okay? Good way to pick out who your friends are, right? Now, he said something that I find really delightful. He said, "For humans, this will be realized in their living together and sharing in discussion and thought. For this is what living together would seem to mean in the case of man, and not, as in the case of cattle, feeding in the same place." I love that line. Okay? If you think that the ancients didn't have humor, I think this is Aristotelian humor. Okay? Look, cows can just stand in the pasture and eat together, okay? But for humans, it's going to take a little more. And I think this is important, because how much of a university student's life, how much of even a sister's life, do you sit next to somebody, okay, and you may be doing the same activity, you may be eating, you may be sitting together in a class lecture, you may even be next to each other in a pew at Mass, but that's not enough. It's not just sitting next to each other sharing an activity. Aristotle says that it's absolutely essential that you share in discussion and thought, that you're actually sharing your thoughts, because we're not cattle, okay? So it's not enough that we just... Now, for a person you've already shared your thoughts with, you can do a lot of common activities together and actually enjoy them on a level that doesn't always require more conversation. But somewhere along the line, for friendship to be developed, you have to share your thought, because you're not a cow. You're not just chewing the same grass. By the way, that you chew, you're saying this is great grass, okay? I mean, that would be a really, like, cow kind of friendship, okay? But we are called to much more than cow friendship, okay? We're called to share our ideas, share who we are. And so it's not enough that we just do things side by side, although that can enrich an already established friendship. If you look at a married couple who've been married forever and are, like, each other's lifelong best friend, they very seldom have these long chats with each other, right? They just kind of sit there on the swing together, and that's just fine and dandy, okay? When you're that far along in the relationship, totally cool, okay? But in order to get to that point, we have to share our thoughts, our dreams, our hopes. I mean, do you ever just sit with somebody and say, "What do you dream of? Do you dream of things? Have we forgotten to dream of things? Are we so practical and technologically driven that we've forgotten how to dream?" Because you're not going to be able to share your dreams with somebody if you don't have any. Dare to hope. Dare to dream. Dare to think. You know, if somebody asks you, "What are your thoughts today?" You know, all we ever ask you, "How are you?" "Fine." But did you ever say, "What did you think about today? What did you think about after class? What did you think about
people might be shocked if you ask them that. And it might actually make them start thinking. All right, so I highly encourage this. Now, this is one of the reasons the so-called hookup culture is deadly to the development of deep friendships. As John Paul II beautifully taught, the body has its own language, and it's meant to be truthful. If you've ever studied any kind of a course on the, or even a book or whatever on the theology of the body, people think it's only about sexual relationship. It's about so much more. It's the theology of the body because we are body, soul, unity. So the things that I express in my body are meant to be united to, in union, with what's in my soul. And all day today, you were living the theology of the body. Okay? Because you were expressing bodily what was from within your soul. The people you smiled at, the people you gave a hug to, the people you shared food with, the people you gave a pat on the back to. You were living, I hope, John Paul's theology of the body. And this truthfulness of the language of the body is what makes it rich and deep. So, an embrace between two friends who haven't seen each other in a while. The kiss between two lovers who really love each other. The full bodily exchange of love between two spouses open to the gift of a child are beautiful, life-giving acts. But any sign of physical affection, any sign, little or big, that is not grounded in the truth of an existing relationship, in the truth of a mutual benevolence, is not constructive but destructive. I mean, we get, if somebody smiles at you because they're genuinely happy to see you, that's something very different than if they smile to get your attention because somehow you are going to be to their advantage. They're nice to you. Do you remember when you were a little kid, and I think people still do this, you were allowed to take in a treat for your birthday. And you tell your, I don't know, your mom or somebody at home made a bunch of cupcakes. They used to just still do this in your generation. And you went in with your little tray of cookies or cupcakes. Maybe you were the health food generation and had to be pretzels or animal crackers. I don't know. And there were food allergies, so no peanut butter. I don't know. So anyway, you came in with your little tray. And something strange would happen. I've taught grade school before. People who don't give you the time of day any other day of the year, suddenly, your best friend, hi, Susie. Here she comes with her tray of brownies.
Yeah, okay.
And they're smiling at you to get your brownie. And they're not smiling at you because they actually treat you well all year round. This is against the theology of the body. We're supposed to be smiling because we really love the person who has the brownies. Now, they also have the added effect of we get the brownie. But we all know it, that the signs that we do with our body are meant to show what's in us. The most classic example of the misuse of the body is the kiss of Judas. Whenever I teach theology of the body, I use that as the icon of the anti-theology of the body. Because what is a kiss supposed to portray? I love you, I'm concerned for you, you're my friend. And we know that's not what it portrayed that night in the garden. And so when John Paul writes against two particular challenges in developing loving relationships, he's not talking only about romantic relationships. It includes friendships, okay? He talks about the dangers of sensuality and sentimentality. The first is obvious. If we overemphasize the pleasures of the body by sensuality, and I say this because with a mostly university setting, I think it is a real kind of cultural pressure that relationships are automatically sexual relationships. And that's a sure way to shortchange developing into deeper friendships. Okay, so if sensuality is overemphasized, it would be really easy to lose sight of the importance of developing the deeper interpersonal bond. But most people don't think about the like danger that comes from sentimentality, and it's in Love and Responsibility that Carol Vitiwa wrote about these two. Okay? Sentimentality is when you overemphasize the emotional experience. So if I just want to be around another person because they make me feel so good about myself, and we stir up all kinds of emotions, we listen to music that makes us all just swoon, okay? But it has nothing to do with caring about them in the bigger personal sense. It's just as destructive as the sensuality. Most people think that the biggest threat to healthy friendships is just the sensuality. But sentimentality is just as much a threat. But both, and this is one thing I love about John Paul II, both he doesn't consider bad in themselves. Humans are meant to be attracted to other humans, okay? Both at the physical level, when it's a male-female relationship that could potentially be a marital relationship, but also at the emotional level, the spiritual level. Like, attraction is the normal response to a perception of a good. If you perceive that something or someone is good, it's normal, healthy to be attracted. If I see a good piece of pizza, I want to eat it, okay? If I meet a friendly person, I want to get to know them. I mean, this is the normal, healthy response of ours. But he said both sentimentality and sensuality are not bad in themselves, but they are only the raw material of real love. And so what has to happen for initial attraction, initial kind of drawing towards another, is that it has to be, he talks about, drawn into a fuller understanding and appreciation of the person as person. You know? That I don't just see the other as, oh, an interesting person just intellectually, I want to have a conversation with them because at least it'll be interesting, or just emotionally, oh, they make me feel so good about myself, or sexually, oh, they're really hot, okay? But do I really, like, look at them as person? This person, and as I come to know the person, and this is why friendship is so important. I mean, even if a couple is going to end up being married to each other, there needs to be a grounding in friendship. I mean, because friendship is what carries us a whole life long. So what needs to happen for us to love the whole person, not just some quality about them, not just some aspect of them? The more time we share together, the more we talk about what really matters to us. When we meet the people who are significant to that person, this is an incredibly important part of getting to know someone, not just seeing them in a void. I mean, every person in here has a whole network of other people that are important to them, especially their family. And the more, you know, I mean, in the classical world of good old-fashioned dating, I mean, nobody went out with somebody one-on-one who hadn't already met their family, right? Because you don't want to be seen as, like, just you. Like, somehow they need to know more about the other people, your friends, your family, because you're not just an object, you're a person, you know? John Paul would say, a person is never just the object of use. Every person is the subject of love. And so we want to broaden our vision of each other, because how are we ever going to find friendship if we stop at only sensuality or sentimentality? For real friendship, we need to actually share that desire for each other's good, but we're not going to be able to share it unless we really know each other as a person. So this communion of life, that's the third quality of virtuous friendship, is what can draw us beyond the surface to realize that this person in front of me has fascinating ways of thinking, has really cool ways of imagining, has a whole world of dreams, a whole world of hopes. And as I get to know them and as I share life with them, then communion of life can be grounded in this sharing of ideas, and that requires good conversation. Good conversation is absolutely key to developing friendship. Now, we all know intuitively the difference between a good conversation and one that's not good. Okay? There's a wide range of topics we could discuss with another person, from something as simple to our favorite foods, our favorite songs, to thoughts about a film or about a book, ideas we're discussing. And there always needs to be a kind of balance between the light and heavy. I'm not saying every conversation must be Aristotelian or Thomistic or you're not becoming real friends. No, that's not true. But I think we're especially challenged today by staying at the level of the really superficial. There's nothing inherently wrong with the tools of social media and technology, but they're just tools. And we have to be careful that we don't stop at a layer that keeps us at the superficial. When we think of, like, Twitter and Instagram, by their very nature, they're about the short and the temporary. And it can be fun to know the latest thought that somebody's had, the latest event, the latest meal date, whatever. But a virtuous friendship cannot be built on even a long series of only superficial little sound bites or little photos or little clips or little tweets, okay? You actually need to know more about the person than that. So keeping tools as tools, what's a great use of technological tools to facilitate real face-to-face communication, bringing people together so that you have the full interpersonal experience of one another, okay? That's what it's a great tool for. So we can use tools to connect so that we then can be really present to each other. C.S. Lewis wrote a brilliant book, which you have never read, you should read, called The Four Loves. And one of the four loves is friendship that he explores. And he said in that book, this quote is from The Four Loves, in the section on friendship, "Those who have nothing
can share nothing.
Those who are going nowhere can have no fellow travelers. I'm going to repeat that. Those who have nothing can share nothing. Those who are going nowhere can have no fellow travelers. So if we want to have the capacity to befriend, it's of essential importance that we have a self to share with someone. You know, my mother is a great wise woman. And when I was a teenager, I remember one day she said to me, "You know, you're really different at different times." And I said, "Oh, what do you mean?" And she said, "Like, I can barely recognize you between different groups of people you hang out with. Your personality is so different with depending on who you're around." And I really, that kind of stopped me in my tracks, because I always thought I was very me, okay? And I was like, well, maybe I'm not. And I wanted her to kind of specify, and she kind of went into more detail with me as I asked. And I realized I was so wanting to please or impress other people that I was trying to be what they wanted me to be so much that I wasn't really sure who I was. I mean, and especially with guys, like, they would say, "Oh, I only like this kind of music." So then I'm like, "I only like that kind of music too," you know? Or they, like, "This is where I like to hang out." So I was like, "I only like to hang out there too." And I was like, "Oh my gosh," like a total cultural chameleon, just fitting in with whatever, and not at all sure of who I was. And I was so grateful my mom said it to me. Because I thought, I don't want to just go with the flow. I mean, I could go somewhere very dangerous, okay? I want to actually be someone. In another of Lewis's great works, he writes, and he said, this book is set in the mythological period, so that gives it time. "How can we see the gods face to face until we have faces?" The name of the book is "Until We Have Faces." It's an amazing book. And I want to take that phrase and say, isn't it true of all relationships? How can we see anyone face to face till we have faces? And what does that mean? If I don't know who I am, if I'm so unsure, if I'm so go with the flow, if I'm so not grounded, how can I have a self to give to you? So there are stages in life where we actually have to work a little on self-development in order to be able to make a better gift of ourselves. I remember teaching this beautiful girl who was a senior in high school, and I mean, all these guys liked her because she was super talented, super lovely, whatever. And she came to me and she said, "Oh, sister, I'm seeing these two different guys." And she described the two different guys to me. And she said, "And he makes me feel great about myself because he does this for me and does that for me. And he makes me feel great about myself because he does this and that. Which one should I go out with and which one should I break up with?" And then I looked at her and said, "You should break up with both now." And I said, "You ask the advice, not me." Okay. And she said, "What do you mean?" Oh, she got all upset. And I said, "You aren't ready to date anyone. Because let me reflect something back to you. Everything you just said to me was about what you receive from them, and you didn't say a word about what you can give them. You're not ready to date." And she said, "What age will I be ready to date?" And I said, "It's not age. When you have a self to give, when you have a self to give." And she did break up with both boys, and she did pull back. And I talked to her about building friendships. I talked to her about building a relationship with God. I talked to her about trying to come to know who she is. And I knew a little bit about her life story. And I knew that her dad's abandonment of her family made her very desperate for men's attention. And I could say, "I know what you're trying to do, but you're not going to find your dad's love in these guys. You got to find your father's love. And once you find yourself in your father's love, you're going to be able to know who you are. And then when you come in and say, it's not going to be two, it's going to be one. And your conversation is going to be about what he does for you and what you give to him. And then I'm going to know that you're actually in love." Okay. So how do we have faces? Presumably, the many years we invest in our education are giving us food for thought, I hope. A chance to reflect on many truths, which are often imparted to us with a great admixture of opinion. The modern student cannot just, I think, go with the flow. I think you have to think a lot about what you're hearing. Doesn't mean you have to be constantly skeptical and totally like, but you have to think critically. We get a lot of opinion and some fact in most of the things that we study. So think hard. Think hard about everything. Don't take what I'm saying just because I said it. Think about what's true. As we study, we cultivate a capacity to think critically, hopefully, to hear and weigh what we hear within our life experiences. As we interact with others, what should a university career be doing for us? As we interact with the others, as we study, hopefully as we pray And I think prayer is absolutely essential to becoming fully yourself. If you want to know who you are, I know no better place. No better. Going in, if you have, I think you all have Eucharistic Adoration time, when the Blessed Sacrament is exposed, the Catholic Church teaches and believes that is Jesus Christ, body, blood, soul, and divinity, present in the Eucharist. You want to know yourself? Go kneel down for some time there. And in the scriptures, when Jesus said to his followers, "Who do you say that I am?" I believe that all prayer is a dialogue of that question both ways. You look at the Lord and tell him who he is for you. He likes you to tell him, "Who do you say that I am? How do you see Jesus? Who do you say he is?" But I dare you to ask the question back and wait for the answer. Say, "Jesus, who do you say I am?" Because guess what? His answer is going to be totally different than what you say when you look in the mirror and what your friends might say, what your family members might say. I bet you anything. I challenge you. Ask him and try to hear the answer. "Who do you say that I am?" Because you're going to learn something about who you are the more time you spend with Jesus. He has a lot to say about who you are, and it's very different than what you see in the mirror. I promise. I'll let him fill in the blanks. Now, one of the most striking differences between Aristotle and Thomas, pretty much everything I've just said, they both say. They both say that virtuous friendship requires benevolence, that it has to be mutual, that it leads to a communion, a sharing of life. One of the most striking differences between the two of them is their understanding of the second characteristic of the mutuality. Because mutuality implies a certain kind of equality, Aristotle, who lived in the time before the coming of Christ, had a much more limited view of who could actually be friends with another person. So some people who study classical literature are like, oh, basically if you read his description of friendship, it's just two philosophers, two old guys talking philosophy on them. That's the only people who could be friends, okay? Because Aristotle did think it was impossible for a friendship to develop between people of different educational levels, different levels in society. Even within the family, he didn't think husband and wife could be friends because they were considered very different socially in the ancient world. They had very different kinds of backgrounds in education. And he definitely thought it was impossible for people to be friends with God, okay? He even entertained the notion that there could be one God. He said, humans can't be friends with the gods because we're too far removed from them. And even if there were God, we're still too far removed. Unbridgeable gap in the mind of Aristotle, because he lived centuries before the coming of Christ. St. Thomas Aquinas had the benefit of living after the incarnation, after the coming of Jesus Christ, who said to his disciples, "I no longer call you servants, but friends, since I've revealed to you all that the Father has shared with me." Jesus is the communion of life that God wills to share with us. We could not have become the friends of God if God hadn't reached out to us. But he did. And he didn't just reach out. He came. He comes. He remains. A striking element of the Gospel and of the New Testament letters is that because not only of the coming of Christ historically, but because of the grace of God that we can still receive daily, live in, abide in, humans can not only be the friends of God, but there are no longer boundaries of who can befriend one another. An amazingly little-known example of this in the Bible is St. Paul's letter to Philemon, in which he writes about Onesimus, who was formerly a slave. In the letter, Paul asks Philemon to receive Onesimus as a brother and to help him on a practical level. Paul explains that even though he had been a slave in the past, and this made Philemon think that they wouldn't have the potential for friendship, in Christ, all are now brothers and sisters. This is the meaning of the famous line that is very often used out of context and very often misused, in which Paul writes that in Christ, there is no male or female, no master and slave, no Jew and Gentile. It's not that we cease to belong to certain social groups or categories, and certainly not that we cease to be who we are. We are who we are. But it is in fact true that in Christ, the barriers between us have been removed. Why? Because the radical revelation of Jesus Christ is that we are, in fact, all children of the Heavenly Father. That we are, in fact, all brothers and sisters of one another. And that we are all capable of true friendship with each other. This is because in Christ, we know more fully than we ever knew before that there is one true great good that we can and should will for all one another. The very best friend we can be and have is the one who knows that we were made in the image of a God who is love, and that we are destined to live forever in a communion of perfect love. Your very best friend will be the one who most desires that you be in heaven. And the very best of friendships are those which, even though time will inevitably cut short in this world, will actually never end. The more we pray, receive the sacraments, and strive to live and walk in the grace of God, the more we will be able to befriend one another. Striving to be a saint is striving to be more of who we are, not less. And it will make us more capable of being friends, true virtuous friends to one another. This house is named for Sadi House. It's named for a young man who, the more he loved God, the more he received the Eucharist, the more he got his friends involved with faith, the more, playing cards, he would bet, and if he won, they had to pray the rosary. They had to make the Eucharistic Holy Hour. This is a good friend. Pier Giorgio Frassati was a great friend. He loved friendship. And he understood that if he was going to be the best friend he could be to his friends, he had to develop his own relationship with the Lord the most profoundly. So if, as Lewis said, those who have nothing can share nothing, and those who are going nowhere can have no fellow travelers, the reverse is also true. Those who know and long for the best and greatest good, God, heaven, have the most to share. And those who are the most sure of their destination can be the best fellow travelers. So let us walk in grace and pray daily for an increase in faith, hope, and charity. And then we will be truly friends to one another. And friends not just here, but in all eternity. Thomas Aquinas said, do we need friends in heaven? He said, well, strictly speaking, he always makes distinctions, right? Strictly speaking, because you'll be so enthralled with the vision of God, you strictly speaking will not need friends. But he said, but in fact, you will reduce more because your friends will be sharing in the vision of God with you. Right? And Thomas Aquinas says, in this life, the ultimate possibilities for friendship are in grace, the divine life within us. But in the future, it will be in glory. When you see your very best friend face to face, and your joy will be increased by sharing that gift with the real friends you had in this world that you helped to get there to the ultimate goal. Okay, that's it.